Well, good morning, and welcome to the December 17th, 2018 Public Utility District Board of Directors meeting. And we'll do our study session this morning and business this afternoon. With that being said, if you have a cell phone, please put it in a position where it's not going to interfere with the meeting, and that would be a good thing. And welcome all. If we have visitors who would like to address the commission, please do so by utilizing the microphone. State your name, address, and we'll give you a reasonable length of time to communicate with the commission. And from there, let's head into the safety minute and Pledge of Allegiance with Dave Parkhill.
I pledge allegiance to the flag of the United States of America and to the republic for which it stands, one nation, under God, indivisible, with liberty and justice for all.
Good morning, commissioners. I'm Dave Parkhill, Safety Training Program Administrator here at the district, and I've got a present. As you know, it's the holiday season. So what I'd like to do before we start our safety minute is, Commissioner Smith, if you can do me a favor, I'm going to pass this to you, and if you could grab a card out of here and then pass it on to Commissioner Congdon, and then once everybody grabs a card, we will start our safety minute.
Okay.
Take a few minutes here.
No peeking?
No peeking. No.
He's peeking. What?
Oh.
No peeking.
You can just grab it. Yeah, the top card's fine. Yeah, they're all
the same.
Yeah. They're all.
You think.
Oh, no peeking.
Great. Thank you, Eric. So on your card, you will see it says give the gift of safety. And I thought, with it being the holiday season, we could talk just briefly about what it means to give the gift of safety. For example, one thing that you could do is give some personal protective equipment to a family member. Maybe they're going to go out and snow blow your driveway. So before they go out, provide some safety glasses, earplugs, maybe some boot chains if you've got a steep, icy driveway that some of you may have. So that's one way you could give the gift of safety. Another way is to offer to help your neighbor hold the base of their ladder while they're up there stringing Christmas lights. That way they can pay attention to where they're stringing the lights. You can ensure that the ladder is going to be secure while they're up there. And then the last example is, if your college-age son is home for vacation, you could have a mini pre-task plan with him before he goes out and shovels the driveway, as he should. So by saying, son, before you go out, dress warmly, dress in layers, watch out for any possible obstacles that might be out there. Is the snow wet and heavy? Is it going to be light? Are you taking breaks? Are you getting plenty of hydration? What have you. So those are just a couple simple ways of giving the gift of safety this holiday season. Any questions? Any comments?
That was great. My husband's a contractor, and no, I don't get jewelry for gifts. I have safety glasses, and I have dust masks, and I have ear protection, and I have the most ergonomic leaf blower. That's what I get for gifts. It's great. It's great. I do appreciate it.
That's wonderful.
Yeah. Yeah, Dave, you know, the sad piece to what you say is so true. I received a phone call late Friday that one of my classmates that I grew up with, putting up his Christmas lights, had fallen off his roof and is no longer with us. You know, and so, you know, we hear it, we think it, we know it, but to emphasize it and to keep emphasizing it, you know, is just really, really important. So please continue to emphasize and give the gift of safety. It's essential. So thank you very much and for all that you guys do.
Well, thank you all, and hope you all have a very Merry Christmas and a very Happy New Year.
Yep.
Great.
Thanks,
Dave.
That was great. That was good.
I just wish it wasn't a reminder, Dave, that we're getting older up at this table. I wish it was my son that was coming home from college, but it's now my grandkids that are coming home from college. But actually, I'd rather have them. I'd rather play around with them out in the snow than my son. So that's it.
Yeah, just gets better.
Not really.
Time. So, commissioners, let's take a look at the agenda. And thoughts you may have related to it.
Mr. President, based on recommendations that we've received, I'd like to suggest that we move items 15, 16, 18, 19, 20, 21, and 22 to the consent agenda.
Is there a second?
Second.
Discussion? Hearing none, those in favor of moving items 15, 16, 18, 19, 20, 21, and 22 from the regular agenda to consent agenda, signify by saying aye.
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 Opposed, no. Motion is carried, and we can go home. Thank you very much. Appreciate that. Any other additions or corrections to the agenda? All right. Item number three, Mr. Wright.
So I want to invite Rich Colson to come up to the table if I could. And while he's coming up, just take a moment to say that this is Rich's this month's winner of the Cycle of Personal Ownership Award. Have a seat, Rich, please. And Rich has been here before, actually, but he's still a very deserving awardee. About a month ago, maybe not that long ago, we had a big windstorm in Leavenworth and some outages. Transformers came down. We discovered that cleaning up the oil was being done in a fairly inefficient way. And I'd like to have Rich describe what he did. But the thing that was, I thought, impressive was that he just recognized that there was a better way to do this. He didn't wait for somebody to tell him to do something. He's actually gone off and figured out a way to pre-position material so that we're in better shape, but also that just the operation itself will be more efficient for our crews to be able to take care of something that has to be done in that moment when we lose transformers. So, Rich, would invite you to just share a little bit about what you've done here with the board.
Sure. Thanks, Steve. As our General Manager Wright said, we had a windstorm, lost a couple transformers. They came down and were leaking in Leavenworth. All of our cleanup material was stored at Holly Street, our Holly Street warehouse. With two transformers down, that wasn't sufficient, so I ended up going to Rocky Reach Dam to get more materials. This is midnight, so it's, didn't find it to be an efficient use of my time, and the cleanup slowed down until I got back. So in conjunction with the transformer shop, who's in charge of cleaning up spills, came up with a plan to, rather than using steel drums to put the waste in, we'd put it in apple bins. Furthermore, we staged cleanup materials at our Chelan Satellite Warehouse and the Leavenworth Warehouse, and with some extras at our Wenatchee Warehouse, and we still have what we needed at Holly Street. It's going to be a little more efficient for us.
Describe for a moment why the apple bins work better than the steel drums.
So picture, if you will, a front-end loader or a backhoe,
yep,
with a scoop full of waste material, and try to funnel that into a 55-gallon drum. Just, it's a square peg, round hole.
Yeah, literally.
So you've got your apple bin. It's a little more efficient. Time-wise, safety-wise, to transfer that material. And on the back end of that, it's easier to load that apple bin back onto the trailer than it is a 55-gallon with the equipment that we deploy out in the field.
sides can move easily as well, so you can get in and out of it easier.
Yeah.
It makes a lot more sense.
Yeah.
Very good.
It does.
Yep.
Right. And Rich, I want to point out that you came to us from Alcoa, what, 3 years ago?
Correct.
Yeah. Well, that's great. Well, good for the PUD. Bad for Alcoa because they lost you, but great for us. Okay. So glad you're here.
I am glad I'm here. Thank you.
Yeah.
Wonderful.
Yeah.
And those are collapsible side bins, as I understand it, the ones that are empty until we need them.
Right. It's just, space-wise, it's easier to have a collapsible bin on top of your cleanup material. You get to your work site, take the collapsible bin off, set up the sides, throw a liner in it.
Yeah, that's cool.
You're good. Then you have your full bin or your fixed-sided bin. If you have additional material, you can, you can use that as well.
Great.
Yeah, I love the initiative.
And I'm really glad the fruit industry could add to the value at the utility.
Once again, thanks to the orchardist, right?
Yeah. Well, and thanks for bringing Randall along with you. We don't get to see him very often. And
well, you know, I get great support from Randall and Mark and Dan. They trust us to do our job.
Yeah. Many people don't know that the first time Randall and I met each other, we were on a small crew sign asphalt going up Grant Road. So we both have a little bit of a different background than we have today. But had a good friendship and trusted relationship for a long time. And am glad that he was able to be here today in a supporting role. Thank you very much. And thanks to all of you for what you do and how you do it and ways for improvement. We get better because we have good people.
Yeah.
So thank you.
Thanks, Rich.
Good team effort.
Yep.
Yeah.
Well, item number four, election of officers. So thought we could perhaps go through that process today and then do the changeover at the first meeting in January. Where we will be in consideration then of what roles the rest of us would like to play in terms of our outside organization participation and internally what we would, you know, care to consider. So, Mr. Smith.
Maybe to jumpstart that process, I've individually talked with several of the commissioners, and I'd like to put a motion nominating a slate on the floor, hoping that it will get a second and see if we can, from the election standpoint, go that way. And I'd like to nominate as a slate Gary Arsenault as president, Steve McKenna as vice president, and Ann Congdon as secretary.
I'll second that motion.
Okay. It's been moved and seconded to submit a slate of officers. Gary Arsenault is president, Steve McKenna is vice president, and Congdon is secretary. Is there discussion? Hearing none, those in favor of accepting the slate as presented signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed, no. Motion is carried. Congratulations or condolences, whichever should come first. Appreciate that. So. We'll save it for the first, but brief foreshadowing of things to come. Thanks for the opportunity this year, and we'll say a little bit more about that next meeting.
I'm going to jump in here really quick,
okay.
Dennis, and say, because I think I'll be at the next meeting, but I just want to give you a huge thank you and a huge amount of admiration for the extreme effort and doggedness and determination on your part, because we know that you have been going through major medical issues. And at the end of a long day, I am really tired, but then I look to you and I think, wow, look at Dennis. He's still hanging in there. So, you know, what am I complaining about? Thank you so much. And
you're welcome.
High regards for your commitment and your supreme effort.
Thank you. Yeah. No, this is a real motivating piece, and the reason why I can get to the end of the meeting is I kind of nap as we go through.
I haven't seen you drooling.
Well, good. That's situational. I'll be glad to hear that. Well, thank you very much. I appreciate that. Number five.
Eric Walkers should be doing the annual update on identity theft program.
Yes, no napping on this one. This is the exciting annual review of the identity theft prevention program. You'll recall, commissioners, years ago that we, the district, pursuant to some federal statutory obligations, developed and adopted identity theft prevention program. One piece of that, both the federal statute and our own program require us to do an annual report of the year, looking backwards and identifying any red flags or any theft that may have occurred. So the good news this year, as last, knock on wood, is that we did not have any violations or breaches of our program or our customer privacy information. We did not receive any fraudulent payments. Carrie Wendell also has asked me to update the board that we, over the last year, have made some significant, I think we perceive them as significant, steps forward to better protect customer information and prevent fraud. The board will recall that we removed largely Social Security numbers from our customer information systems, keeping only those last five digits that would be necessary to identify in the event that there was a collection action necessary. And then we do use a third-party exchange to verify all new customer identities as they come in. In addition, this year we're upgrading, as you know, the CIS system, so we hope to continue to capture opportunities to better protect customer information and customer privacy and payment information into the future. So another good year. Hopefully those will continue. We continue the efforts annually to always get better. Questions? That's all I have.
All right. Thank you very much. Item six.
So we wanted to take advantage of the opportunity that we're at a moment when we would normally be doing the closeout for Unit C8 at Rocky Reach. But because this was a part of this large unit repair, it's been a very big issue for us, a big workload issue for us over the course of the last 5 years. Thought it was an opportunity to revisit where we've been on this project and what it means for us with respect to the remaining three large units. Scott Tidd will be doing this presentation. Kirk Hudson is here because the project is actually, as we're describing it today, is even bigger than the resolution, the closeout resolution. So he's here to provide some support for Scott as well.
Good morning, Kirk Hudson, Managing Director of Generation and Transmission. With me is Scott Tidd, Project Manager. And Steve set the context well for this. You do have a resolution that's at least on the consent agenda related to final acceptance related to this presentation. I will say this before I turn it over to Scott, just that major milestone, as Steve alluded to, and it's been a long time coming since the day we found a cracked servo rod at Rocky Reach on one of our large units. And Scott Tidd, a very accomplished project manager, it seems that we give Scott our biggest challenges. We gave him this when it was in a state of flux at Rocky Reach, and he's in the process of transitioning from the large unit repairs. He's got those fairly well programmed now, once a year to go through those units systematically and make those longer term repairs, and we've transitioned him down to Rock Island, where we have our hands full. So because of his good work, we put him on our biggest challenges. So
this is what you call a reward or punishment?
It's a reward. We keep telling him it's a reward. So with that, I'll turn it over to Scott.
Thank you very much, Kirk. I wondered if the right word would have been relegated. C8, very dear to my heart. We went through a lot of things, a lot of unforeseen events through the 5 years of the urban rehab program. So we've got three things here that we want to talk about. Final acceptance of Unit C8. We're going to review lessons learned, and we're going to take a view of the project moving forward. So I've got a series of slides to follow that actually, I guess you could call them reminders of some of the events that we faced. As Kirk said, we found the crack in the servo rod in C10 in September. Actually, C10, it tripped out in March of 2013. So it took us until September before we, through the evaluation process, we found the problem. We had an emergency declaration for additional head gates and temporary blade blocks, and that was in October of the same year. And we proceeded with blocking the blades on all four units. We completed that in April of 2014. The emergency declaration, we actually repurposed some concrete head gates. So we, as of yet, had not purchased and manufactured a new set of steel head gates. We actually repurposed concrete head gates. It saved us a bit of time.
That allowed us to go ahead and unwater the units and get the blade blocks on before we had the additional head gates.
Throughout that process, all of our stators on the large units shorted out, and we entered a program to rewind them all. And that started in February of 2015, and we finished them up in August of 2017. It worked out that we were able to do all four units sequentially, and that became important when you start thinking about utilizing the same contractor team. So we just were getting better and better and better as each one came at us. We started the first unit outage on the turbine repairs in June of 2015, and not long after that, we declared an emergency for bridge crane hoist drum repairs. And then in May of 2016, that was the emergency declaration for new head covers. So that came out of refurbishing the existing head cover of C8, and we found irreparable cracks. So in May of 2016, we declared an emergency. Some of you may remember that. We got the new head cover and then discovered it didn't fit with the bottom ring. That was in January of 2017. We got it fixed, got the new head cover accepted, and that was not until June of 2017. Coming out of the hoist drum crack discovery, we had decided we better step into the full powerhouse bridge crane rehab project. So we did that from August of 17 to April of 2018. C8 was fully commissioned, complete, made available on December 15th of 2017. So nearly 5 years later. This next slide is on the project budget. C8 repairs are complete. C9, the unit has been disassembled. Work is underway back at Voith's shop in York, Pennsylvania, and work is underway in the turbine pit. Both of those units, C8 and C9, those estimates of completion have factored in the recovery that we got from liquidated damages from the contractors. And that was primarily based on the head cover issues. So the next slides deal with lessons learned. Site safety being the first one. Want to point out to everybody that throughout this whole process, we did not have a single incident of injury or illness. We did have an event. We had an unplanned rotation of C8 while it was out for repairs, and it sort of increased our awareness of our safety program and especially of our stop work authority.
You might recall there was a board presentation on that in 2015, I think, on that event itself.
Kirk, would you speak to why we believe that we're in a position to say that's very unlikely that would happen again.
Yeah, so during that process, what ended up happening was there were head gates that were removed while the wicket gates were open, which allowed water to pass through and the unit to turn, which we didn't want to have happen. And so not only reviewing our clearance procedures and processes and reinforcing those, we also put mechanical devices in, which are bars that prevent you from actually going down and picking a head gate up. What has to happen to remove those bars first is you actually have to take a, correct me if I'm wrong, I'm going to explain how I understand this to work, but you have to take a key that can only be pulled out of a wicket gate slot if the wicket gates are closed. And then that key is used to actually remove the bar that you would actually have to take off to remove the head gates. So it's a physical device that you have to unlock and then, or actually lock, then unlock, and then you can get the crane down to pull the head gates.
So is that a retrofit that we have now on all of our gates?
We're in the process of retrofitting them all. We made our way through, and we're working our way through, yeah.
Unless you you said that right.
Yeah. Again, it's just a reminder that even best laid plans and processes, there can be things that fail along the way that we don't expect, and so we try and put things in place where it's very difficult for a process step to be missed.
Yeah, very good. Lessons learned continued. Quality of new head covers. So we went through a learning process here whereby we've figured out that we've got to take verification measurements after the parts have been moved from the machining tool. So the head covers, all assembled, machined on the vertical mill. That's not where you take your final verification measurements. It gets moved, it gets reset up, and so we learned that. We also learned that we take our verification measurements while the head cover is assembled. So when you think about that, it got machined while it was assembled. You don't take measurements when it's apart. It just doesn't work. And the other thing that helped us on this project is that we had pre-purchased the new head covers from the same contractor that's performing the line boring in the field. That's Andres. Part of our decision-making process was to utilize metallurgical engineers and have them do analysis on existing parts. So basically, they can evaluate it, microscopically and help us make a decision on whether that component should be scrapped, repaired, or left it as is. And we've got some real good data that's come out of that on our existing components. So moving forward, in January, you're going to get an update on the progress of C9, and you're going to be asked to ratify field work orders for the three remaining large units. And then we've got a little blurb here about insurance recovery. Lots of efforts are underway there. We've received payments for C10 to date of approximately $4.35 million. We've received payments to date for C8 of approximately $1.33 million. There's payments pending for all three units, C8, C9, and 10. I'm a little bit out of order here. But the insurance company has acknowledged that the servo rods of C8, C9, and C10 are cracked. We had to do some metallurgical analysis on C8 in order to prove that it was a crack and not just a machining scratch. So they've acknowledged that. And
the reason C11 isn't on there is we haven't had a chance to look at it yet. We have blade blocks on it, and we've been operating the unit since then. So we still have to disassemble that unit before we can determine whether or not there's a crack on that one.
In conclusion, there were many turning points over the course of the almost 5 years since C10 tripped offline. That was March 25th, 2013. I give credit to a lot of participants and stakeholders that assisted us with unraveling the unforeseen issues encountered. Overcoming the challenges, C8, man, it's a powerhouse, was returned to commercial operation safely and with a quality that should see the unit run reliably during its 30-year design life. The schedule for future units is estimated at 14 months. C9 is underway. It's projected to be completed in August of 2019.
Just to reinforce that that third point, would you guys review for a moment the engineering work that was done to look at the overall unit as opposed to just looking at the servo rod?
Yeah, we had a service agreement, an SATA, with various engineers who were doing, we use the word holistic engineering, where parts are evaluated. We use the word static FEA, so it's getting a stress analysis in conjunction with fatigue analysis. So these are add-on engineering studies, and those fatigue studies are to evaluate the cyclic changes of all of these parts, right? Plus, you know, negative and positive, it's going both ways, how often and for how long. These factor into the actual life of parts. And so, as Steve mentioned, we used a lot of engineers to help us with decision making on how we go forward with each of these components.
Mr. Congdon.
I just, you know, when we see this all laid out like this, all the different things, it clearly is, has to feel like one step forward, two steps back. So I, you know, my, you know, kudos and congratulations to you guys for doing so well and hanging in there. All I can say is it's a really good group, terrific group, and thank goodness you have a leader like Kirk who's patient and calm and, you know, and believes. Wow, great work.
Sometimes.
It's been a struggle.
Thank you. Calm like the duck.
Yeah, thanks, Andy. Well,
that's Steve. I forgot.
That's right.
There's a duck.
So the C8 resolution that's on the consent agenda basically is asking for a couple of things. Ratification of Field Work Order 1-19. Which is for a considerable credit, a contract value reduction, because we took estimated quantities and corrected them to actual shop and site. And then the resolution asks for acceptance of C8. You know, there's one thing that I did want to go back and comment on, and that was on the budget. So, you know, we... Overall, it was and I think it says it in the resolution, that it's an overall reduction in contract price for the contractor on this first unit. So, you know, we did certain things that got us there. We broke out some of the work and we bid it out ourselves. Some of it we just performed ourselves. So we did some things to try and save the customer owners of the PUD, you know, try and do the best job we can when it came to the budget. So.
Eric, should those be two separate resolutions?
So the final acceptance and ratification of the field recorder change order that's on your consent agenda is one resolution and should be taken that way. Then the release of the next unit that Scott mentioned will be okay. Later in the afternoon.
Okay.
So separated is.
Okay.
And that's now on consent, right?
No.
No.
No, that is not. That
not
is
unit 5.
That's 17. The consent is final acceptance.
Yeah.
Okay.
Oh, yeah.
C8 is.
C8 is, yeah. On consent. That's the final acceptance.
So I guess I'll see you again.
Changed after you stop us. Are there any questions?
Just a comment. Not even sure where it fits or if it does. But there's been some coverage of a segment of bridge dealing with the new tunnel in Seattle, where the concept of metallurgist comes into play. There are some pins and other metal parts that have memory, and a flexible concrete. And so, you know, for dam applications, expansion and contraction, etc., what they're saying is that should an earthquake occur, this particular bridge or segment of bridge in its experimental length, theoretically, will pull itself back together and realign because of the smart metals that have memory and a flexible concrete that surrounds them. And then you start thinking about the water differential temperatures, expansion and contraction in dams. It just kind of makes me wonder, you know, in the future or in terms of repair, et cetera, you know, where we would be in taking a look at those unique products that are now being produced that are differentiated from traditionally what we have and what we've been doing. But it's just kind of one of those where you're looking at that and going, huh, you know, there's got to be something there because it's large, it's concrete, and it's steel. You know, it's metal. It's like, isn't that our business? You know, but anyway, just a thought. Mm-hmm. But the metallurgists, their role in our future is so significant. You know, so.
Thank you for that.
A lot of work being done, you know, on and near the Hanford works related to smart metal.
Yeah, I think to that point, you know, the metallurgic analysis that we had done, certainly we typically see cracks, we are determined to repair them. And some of the things we learned in that process was those cracks very likely were there just after casting and aren't an issue in terms of the piece of equipment. And so we've certainly learned a lot along the way that we don't have to necessarily repair every crack that's out there, but understand, you know, what's causing that crack, what caused it, how long has it been there, and how does it impact the equipment.
And you think about self-repair at a molecule at a time. Mm-hmm. Kind of an interesting concept. Mm-hmm. So who knows where it'll go.
Interesting point.
I would like to thank Scott, just if there aren't any other questions, and you can see from the timeline, this wasn't a simple find a crack and repair it. There was so much that happened along the way once we took the unit apart, and just from all the things that he had to work with in terms of bridge cranes being out of service, head covers not being repairable, not enough head gates, so modifying concrete stop logs to work on unwatering situations, just pretty amazing to get to this point. So thank you, Scott.
Thanks a lot, Kirk. Thank you, commissioners. Everybody.
Thank you.
And Scott, I just ask you to hang around this morning because I think we're a little bit ahead of schedule. We might be able to get to your item this morning and then free you up for the afternoon.
Very good. Thank you.
Good. Okay.
Thank you, gentlemen. Do you want to move on to manager items?
No, what I would like to do is we've got lessons learned from these are all closeouts of contracts that were on consent, but there were some interesting lessons from each of these. I'd like to start with Gary Rice. Come on up. And Gary, you've got some pictures, as I understand it.
Yes, I got some pretty good pictures. I'm Gary Rice. I'm project manager on this project in the Engineering Project Management Division. And the first picture I tried to show here was an in-construction picture that just I can pretty much talk about the whole project right from this picture, but then I'll run through the sequence of construction rather quickly. So what we have here is the bank line on Chelan Falls Powerhouse Park. This is just downstream from the powerhouse itself. It had been eroding away from two things. One is the flow of the powerhouse, which runs in parallel with the bank line. And two is the flow from the Chelan River, which is the more damaging flow. It's a lot higher. And you can actually see a divot right here that was eroding away. So what my lessons learned on this project have to do with are mainly constructability reviews and how we can foresee problems that may occur, balance those risks, but all brought out from how we envision what the project's going to look like before we actually build it. So with the challenges that we had, with the type of erosion that was occurring, we contracted out to Anchor Environmental to come up with a design for us. The design had a few different components to it because not all of the erosion was the same. The lower section here that receives the erosion from the Chelan River is the area that received the most damage. So it actually has rocks that go 6 feet down in below the riverbed surface. The upper section doesn't have quite as many rocks. It maybe goes down half that distance, about 3 feet. But in order to make it through permitting, permits don't usually like to have rock-hardened bank lines. We struck a little bit of a balance with the fishery agencies, and we put additional woody debris in the areas that would have less velocity and more rocks in the areas that would have greater velocity. We also had elevation to deal with, and there were two main parameters at the onset of design. One was to maintain the existing bank line, not to vary it. We don't want to make it just straight. We want to keep it the way it looks. And two, don't lose too much park real estate, because that park real estate is valuable to us. So in laying out the design, one thing that we found was there was an area that was improved as part of the Reach for habitat, putting in fish spawning beds, and that raised the elevation of a bunch of the area in front of our bank line. So it was easy to do water isolation because it wasn't very deep. As we got just to the upper end of it, that's part of the original channel, and it was fairly deep. We thought that we could still use our planned method of using bulk bags, which are like gunny sack bags, about a cubic yard each, and then you build an isolation wall so you can do your water isolated away from the river. We thought we could use those for the whole project. As it turned out, it was very difficult to build that bulk bag wall down at the lower or the upstream most end of the project. So we had to change methods partway through. So that was the first lesson learned was, you know, really make sure that the methods that you're proposing can actually occur. And we had a good working relationship with Pipkin Construction that built this project. So we were able to redesign, contact the agencies and get there before or have that all done before we got there. And there was actually no cost change in changing methods. And I'll show you in the photos what the different methods look like. The second one would seem fairly obvious. It has to do with this parking lot right here. As we were designing and building, it didn't look like there would be any problem. But the construction manager that we had on site working for us looked at that. And he has experience building parks. And he said, all of our new plantings here are going to be susceptible to a runoff from a rain event that was normally protected because the ground was fairly hardened, and now we've disturbed it with new plantings that we'll establish over time. So he foresaw that we would maybe have a problem there and then actually designed a solution that we didn't know if we'd implement or not during construction. And as it turned out, we had a rain event in early November, and we did have a problem, and we saw it washed around some of our new plantings. So we were able to do a fairly quick change that the contractor was prepared to do, and it only took about 4 hours to install it, so it didn't cost very much money. That one did add a little bit of money, but the lessons learned there is don't just look at where you're building the project. Look beyond it and see what kind of exterior forces can maybe cause you problems. So those are our main two lessons learned that we wanted to document on the project. What I'd like to do is just go through very quickly and show you how the project was built. All right, this is the project looking upstream towards the powerhouse before we did anything. And the swim beach was eroding here. We ended up putting in a couple terraces outside of the water to control the slopes there so that wouldn't erode. And then you can see some of the water flows hitting right here. That's the Chelan River. And that's just under normal low flows. Under high flows, it hits it much harder. And then you have the sweeping velocity coming from the powerhouse. So the first thing that the contractor chose to do was build a lower access road. We actually have two platforms. We have a lower platform that will have plantings that are riparian that will grow well down in the lower water area than we have upper plantings. So Pipkin Construction's construction method was to excavate down above the ordinary high water level, create an access road, then build in the water isolation so we could build the lower level, all the rocks and the woody debris and everything that was to go in. So here they're about halfway done with building the lower access. Okay, here is putting in those bulk bags I told you about, and those are built in a pyramid. If they only need to be about 5 feet tall, you would put two in the base and one up above it, wrap it in plastic, and that would give you your water isolation. As we went through there, three rows high was pretty much what we needed until we got to the end, and then we found that we couldn't get the bulk bags to stay on this steep slope, so we had to change methods. So this is the full system in place and working. Another contractor proposed method was to isolate the work area into cells and then pump that slightly just to create a little bit of positive force, and it keeps the murky water from going out into the river. It was a good idea proposed by them. Here is also some of the 3 to 4 foot diameter rocks that create the lower armament. This is looking back up just as soon as we're almost done with the bottom area, the lower level. You can see the large woody material. These are trees that have about a 20-foot straight section on them, plus the root wad end. They were harvested specifically for this project.
So, Gary, where's when the water's up to 1,100 feet? Or, well, no, it'd be the Columbia River level, whatever that is. How high is the is the water level going to go?
You see this row of root wad sticking out here?
Yeah.
Ordinary high water, and that's like as high as you expect to see it under normal operations, is halfway up on that.
So those are sticking out of the water.
Yeah, so we have about a foot and a half to 2 feet of freeboard.
Is that not the swim area? Is there no swimming in that area?
Nope, that's not the swim area.
Is that cordoned off or something so that people know they're not supposed to swim there?
Yes, we've put a fence up. I mean, there is a fence up there. There's traditionally been a fence in place.
So
this area is allowed for fishermen access and also for non-motorized boats, rafts, kayaks, that sort of thing.
So the swim area is up closer to the powerhouse?
The swim area is actually further down towards the bridge in the Columbia River.
So it's around the bend there?
Yeah, let me just back up real quick and
show you. The reason I'm asking is because I've had a couple people ask me about it, and they had some questions, some concerns. So
okay. Are you able to see the cursor right here?
Mm-hmm.
This is the swim area around the corner. So from the end of the rockery all the way over that you can't quite see through these trees. There is a floating line mm-hmm. that's supposed to keep the swimmers inside this bay.
Mm. And so was there any work done along the swim area? Any addition of big boulders and root wads and
what we put in were these rockery walls right here. And you're allowed to go up to 2.5 feet tall with those walls per code. So if someone falls off 2.5 feet, they figure they're not going to get hurt. But we took an extra measure. Once we looked at it, we were trying to envision someone coming along playing Frisbee and mm-hmm. falling off of the top level and then landing on the second level, you know, because they're staggered. So we actually put in a new fence as part of the project that wrapped around that upper rockery wall right up around here. So where you see these picnic tables, there is a continuation of the fence that wraps around to the swim beach area.
And the water will be how much higher than what we're looking at right now?
You know,
it varies,
but not very much. It's pretty stable about where it looks like now. It would maybe be a foot and a half higher at ordinary high water.
Okay. Maybe sometime after the meeting I'll catch up with you and
share
a couple things.
The last slide here will probably give a better angle to show it to you as well. All right, so we did survey in everything as we went along so we could replicate the bank line. And this upper end right here is where the water gets deep. So what we did is we put together this drawing to show ahead, of course, of the actual construction getting there. And we gave it to Edry Risden down in our real estate department to take to the permitting agencies. And because we had this planned out before we actually got to it in construction, and Edry was also in talks with the permitting agencies and was able to actually get a decision in a day that this plan could change.
That's a miracle.
But what we did was we had everything thought out. This floating silt fence that you see here, it's a proven technology. We just didn't think that would work for the whole project, so it wasn't permitted that way because of the velocities. But as it turned out, we were doing powerhouse repairs at the same time. We weren't running the powerhouse, so we had calm flows, so this technology would work. And here you can see the silt curtain. It's this floating boom and how well it holds in the murky dirt compared to the murky water compared to the clean water. So we're just pulling out right now in building the first level. And then, like I said, the bulk bag wall will then be removed. So we remove that wall, and we have a platform here to create a planting surface now. Now the planting surface is being created. We have the second rockery wall that helps us save as much park real estate as we can. And then here we are ready to be planted. Notice the wavy design of it that mimics what was there originally. This area off to the right is where we had that rain event and it washed away some of the soils. So this is the small drainage basin that we designed and put in place. That didn't take too long to build. We had all the site materials on site to do it. Here you can see the fence that's up that you were mentioning. So this is a replacement of the fence that we already had there. But the one thing I might mention, this is the finished product here, is that it within 5 years, maybe tend to be completely hidden. These rockery walls, you won't even be able to see them. The willow that grow up, and the different upland plants that we put up above, they're going to create habitat there and shade and some fish habitat as well. This access for fishermen was already there, so we just replaced it in the same place.
So, Gary, are you concerned about the fishermen? I was going to ask you where the access was for the fishermen, but so they can come down through there on that road, and then they can walk down along there where your cursor is to fish? So we're not concerned about the liability of that woody debris?
No more than what we were originally when we had it. Fishermen would go down there. Just like we would normally do, this little sign you see here, you know, tells them to please stay off the sensitive vegetation, and they're not supposed to go there. But just like they walked out there previously, I think they would walk out there again. Those rocks are pretty good for standing on. We do have a fence all the way along it, you know, and it'll be signed to not go down there, but we may have created an attraction.
So, you know, the whole woody debris thing in Lake Chelan has been a huge issue forever.
Is this the floating woody debris, right, that comes down every year?
No, the woody debris that was mandated that goes in for fish mitigation, because the woody debris there is fish friendly. The fish can hide in that woody debris, right?
Right.
But at least, you know, in Lake Chelan, with it moving up and down the way it did, we'd have woody debris in at a certain level, and then the lake would be maybe 5 feet above it, and then as the lake goes down, it might be a foot above the woody debris, and people can't see it. And
they hit it with boats.
It was a hazard, or swimming, diving, and... But, I mean, that's unsightly, but I guess that's what we have to provide for fish, right?
Yeah, one thing we have here is the elevation is fairly constant. It may vary about 2 feet, and it's controlled by the Columbia River for the most part, unless we're doing a large spill down the Chelan Gorge. So we're not going to see a huge variation there.
Yeah.
And this is an area that's closed for boating, or power boats anyhow. And the designated swim area is around the corner away from this.
Yes, yeah. Okay. Thanks. Yeah, I'm just have questions because of questions people posed to me.
All right, this photo shows what it looked like pre-construction, and then this is what it looks like afterward. So the swim beach area is supposed to end at this buoy line, and the rockery walls I was talking about are right here to help erosion from the swim beach area. This is actually a boat launch that was existing that we just built around. It's a primitive boat launch for just carrying kayaks and that sort of thing down. Yeah, there you can actually see the fence that we put in around the corner, around the top of the rockeries. And we put that in there just to discourage people from going down there, and so that they, if they have kids happen to be running, they're not going to fall down that.
Is the swim beach any larger than it? I mean, is it the same size as it's always been?
Yeah, we didn't do any work in the swim beach.
Okay, so that's part of the problem. I think people think that that section right there used to be swim beach, and now it has big boulders on it. So
no, this area right through here was all vegetated, and there was even a fence that came down here. to keep people out of there, and that wasn't ever a swim beach.
Mm-hmm. Thanks.
Mm-hmm. So those were the lessons learned mainly, was to look and try to find things in the constructability review phase so that if you do run into problems, you have them well thought out. Any other questions?
Just a comment. I think you guys have done a great job. I'm anxious to go up there and take a look at it in person. Your pictures are great. Mm-hmm. A lot of effort went into it, so thank you.
Thank you.
Yeah.
Thanks, Gary. Commissioners, okay, I'd like to go a little bit out of order here. I've got a manager's item that Dan Frazier was going to present, and we can free him up to get to another meeting that would be useful for him to be at. Make a presentation, just talk a little about where we're going with the GCCM application process for the facilities project.
Thank you, Steve. Dan Frazier, Director of Shared Services. So as Steve mentioned, we're diligently working through the process for the service center. Met with Commissioner Congdon this morning, and we'll be meeting with the other commissioners over the next few days to talk about where we are. But the process to bring a contractor on board to help us with the design and eventual construction, potentially, is a lengthy one. And so to get to the state project approval process is one we'd like to get started on as soon as we can. And they take applications on the even-numbered months for a meeting on the odd-numbered months. And so we would like to make an application in December for the January meeting. This would be the application as we did for the Rock Island project. So it really talks about what the scope of the project is. It's just the ability to go out and see if there's a contractor, a contract team that would be interested in being part of this project. So we envision this project to follow a similar process as the Rock Island project, the general contractor, construction manager, alternative delivery, as we are now. This will be the third one. It'll be the fourth project requested by APUD. Three of them are Chelan County PUD projects. So Rock Island facilities, the Powerhouse 2 modernization, and then this would be the third. We have stayed with the GCCM process. As you know, the Rock Island project is looking at using a design build process. We think with architectural projects, the GCCM process is still a better method. And so we'd like to stay with that. We are currently preparing the application for submission later this week, if the board concurs with our recommendation to go that direction. What would happen after this is we would be giving a presentation to the project review committee in January in Seattle, and would hopefully get approval to pursue what's called an RFP, which is a request for proposals. And it's really functions more like a request for qualifications. So we hear from contractors interested in the process, and then there's a lengthy interview and selection process. And this wouldn't really culminate until June of next year that we'd be contracting. So that's why we'd like to get an early start on this, because we think it behooves us to meet some intended deadlines if we do move forward to have a GC. So there is no obligation to go out for an RFP or to select anybody over time. This is just authority to essentially go test the waters and see if there is a contractor that we can partner with that would be interested in this project.
And I want to reinforce, this is not a decision whether to proceed with the facilities out there. This is part of our due diligence process to better understand the costs and see how they compare against our planning estimates. But without being able to move forward with this, we wouldn't have that additional information that we need to be able to make that assessment. And you may recall from our previous times through this, it does not require an action from the board. It's the board that the group will be presenting to in Seattle does like to hear whether our board has been informed and has any objection to proceeding. So unless there's an objection, we'll just be moving forward with that request later this week.
Seems like it's a really important step to even assess if there's a general out there that is willing to step forward or more.
Yeah, and our intent is to come on into the first meeting in January with a little more of a presentation to let you know what we will be telling that board, because our presentation, the application really just talks about the project. Our presentation will talk about who we are and what we intend to do. So the board will have another opportunity to look at the information prior to our interview at the board.
So since a key part of the decision-making process will be based upon the price of moving forward, it seems that this would be a logical step to come up with an estimate in price.
It is really good. We always have a lot of assumptions. When you're going into projects like this, you have to make a lot of assumptions. And so each one we can start to validate really helps us understand where we are in the process.
Without objection, we'll take the next step.
Keep moving.
Great. All right. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
I invite Court Hill to come up, talk about a project that should recently completed in the parks. And this is a consent agenda item, but some useful lessons learned here.
So, Court Hill, project manager, engineering project management division. And the closeout, the lessons learned I'm doing is on the number 2 Canyon storm pipe replacement project. This project was started construction in September, and we completed the end of October. The contractor for this job was J&K Earthworks out of East Wenatchee. I have on the screen behind me a couple or a few photos to show you that go along with the first lesson learned item that I'd like to share with you. We have quite a bit of park land on the riverfront, and one of the lessons learned that we have is that future projects which involve excavation in the riverfront park should anticipate encountering unsuitable material and therefore additional cost to dispose of the objectionable material and also to import and place acceptable fill material. This is a photo of where the storm pipe started near a parking lot and then extended out to the river, but this is a connection to a manhole. And the pipe that we replaced was a wood stave pipe. So you can see some remnants of that wood stave pipe. It's been removed. But the connection to the manhole, when they made that connection, they poured a bunch of concrete at the connection point. And that was part of some material that we didn't anticipate encountering.
Is there anybody here old enough to remember the last time wood stave pipe was installed? Maybe the 1920s?
Yeah, we believe this wood stave pipe was salvaged from another location because it was installed at this location in the 60s, and they'd stopped making wood stave pipe in the late 40s.
Okay.
So, yeah, it's old.
I've seen it at Lake Chelan for gravity irrigation lines. I've
seen it in my orchard.
Have you?
This is a better photo here of the wood stave pipe. Try to move the cursor over here. I don't know if you can see it or not, but that's the wood stave pipe there. And right above it, you'll notice the fill material that was placed above it. There's a bunch of concrete in it. So yep. When they backfilled it, they took what was available and put it on top, thinking that it would never need to be taken out again, which wasn't the case.
Whatever fills the hole the fastest.
Yeah.
That was... This was all agricultural area, wasn't it?
Probably was originally, and then it the owner that we purchased it from was a salvage yard, a salvage company. So this is a large piece of concrete that was also placed in there. You can see we had to cross underneath a city storm, 18-inch storm, gravity storm line, and they had bedded that storm line with a sewer line with a bunch of concrete, so we had to yard out that big piece of concrete there. And then the last photo here is another big piece of concrete that was embedded in the backfill that we had to yard out. So the last lesson learned I'd like to share with you is just about the inception of this project. In 2016, we identified a sinkhole there in the area right next to the loop trail. So the appearance of a sinkhole is really indicative of a subsurface condition which warrants immediate investigation and possibly emergency action to remedy and protect the public. The quick actions of district staff to plate the widening sinkhole and fenced the area and reroute the loop trail traffic was a noteworthy action. And there was additional cost to take these safety measures, as well as additional cost to cost incurred during construction to dewater and remove the sediment-laden storm pipe. These costs could have been avoided or at least minimized if the district had chose to pursue a more aggressive schedule.
So that second lesson learned, let me own that one, because I was the one who had reservations about moving forward, candidly, because I wanted to make sure we understood where the ownership was of this stormwater pipe, and candidly didn't seem quite right to me that the PUD owned a stormwater pipe that was put in a long time ago and was part of the drainage for Canyon Number 2. But Eric clarified that for me with a fairly robust legal analysis. But it probably would have made more sense. In fact, it would have made more sense, looking back on it now, to have not waited for the legal analysis, just to move forward. So we all have a chance to learn. This is one for me.
Any other questions? Thank you.
Thanks, Court.
Thank you.
Last one of these projects is Chris McDermott has one. Again, this was from the consent agenda. But Chris had done a really good, thoughtful job on his lessons learned analysis. And Vern Chamberlain was the project manager.
Vern Chamberlain, project management department manager.
Chris McDermott, system operations manager.
So this project replaced the 14 video screens in the System Operations Center, CTC. They were on life support. You know, I'm not sure how many were working at the time we did this, maybe 10 or 12. But anyway, the contract, it was an RFP awarded to AVISPL out of Tampa, Florida. And they did a good job on the easy part, I guess. I thought it was the hard part, demoing the old screens and rebuilding the new wall to fit the new screens, and then installation of the new screens. I mean, that was done in record time. And I thought we were going to be here a year ago accepting this almost. But we had problems with the controller, and it's fairly technical hardware, software information, and Chris can do a good job explaining what really happened there.
So the majority of the project actually went very well. There were really two events that led us to some delays and additional costs. The first one was InFocus Corporation's acquisition of Jupiter Systems, and the second was Microsoft's decision to split their operating system into two separate tracks, one that would get continuous updates and enhancements, and the other one that would get no updates ever again. So we first started working on the RFP. There was really only one industry leader that focused these types of video controller solutions on control centers and on the utility sector, and that was Jupiter Systems. InFocus is a company that focuses more on conference rooms and smaller scale sectors. And after they purchased Jupiter, as they developed the company over the last couple of years, they've shifted their focus away from the utility sector and customer service. So after we released the RFP, Microsoft made a fateful decision in those two separate tracks that impacted us as well. When they split the two tracks, it created a conflict for us between our energy management system vendor and our video provider. So InFocus chose the track that would never get updates, because that made it easier for them to maintain their product. And our EMS provider chose the other track, the one that would get updates, so that there would be enhancements that they could take advantage and make a better product for us going forward. So that conflict created a situation where our EMS provider said that they would not guarantee support for this video controller. And so that resulted in us having to, late in the RFP, after it had been released already, going back and disqualifying Jupiter from that part of the process where it had been our preferred vendor originally. If either one of these two initiating events had not occurred, it would have been a very boring project, which would have been nice. We would have preferred that. As a result of either one of those things occurring, which were difficult to foresee what those other companies' decisions would be, it led us down that path. We run our EMS directly on the video wall, which gives us the best bang for the buck. It allows our system operators to utilize the video system far greater than any other utilities that we've talked to, which we feel is why we're buying the video system, is to use it. And so we really feel like we get a lot more use out of it than what other utilities do. However, that did cause a conflict with the video controller manufacturer. So that leads us to our lessons learned. In the future, we should heavily consider using industry norms, even when we think it will cause us to be less efficient. If we think going another route is still a better idea, we should try to find a way to make it as similar to industry norms as possible without giving up those efficiency gains. Number two is to be more specific in the RFP in identifying hardware and software compatibility requirements. And finally, a factory acceptance test would have cost more, but would have mitigated some of the risk as well. We're really excited for the new system. The old system was 14 projectors that each had two bulbs in them, and each lamp lasted about 10 to 11 months. But that meant that our technicians were in there every year replacing those. And so if you have 28 lamps that have to be replaced, you know, it's one every 2 weeks roughly, they're getting in there and they're having to work on the projectors. And so that's throwing the system out of alignment. It's causing a lot of maintenance issues. And finally, those lamps aren't very cheap. They cost almost $600 a piece. So it was an expensive process, not to mention the time. Our technician time seems to be more and more valuable as we put in all these other systems throughout the district. And so their time becomes one of the valuable things that we're having to expend as well. So the new system uses LEDs and has no consumables, so we don't expect to have to do any required maintenance for over 11 years. So going from every 2 weeks to 11 years is a huge gain for us. So that's one of the primary things that we're looking for, so the alignment should stay in place longer. And so we should also have overall reduced costs from a maintenance perspective, not just time, but money as well. So are there any other questions about this project? Well, thank you.
I'm just amazed at what the change in technology in the last 20 years makes me wonder what the next 20 years is going to look like. And it's an exciting time, but it's also can be a frustrating time, as you've just experienced. And on the personal level, I've had an iPad for 6 or 7 years, and I'm now attempting to download apps that my iPad no longer supports. And so that's really not a fair comparison whatsoever, but for me, it hits home that we got to keep changing, updating, and I'm betting in 5 years we're going to find out we have to do something different again.
Well, the original video system was only projected to last 5 to 7 years, and we had it installed for approximately 14 years. We really tried to do as much maintenance and stretch it as long as we could. We knew that was kind of going to be the goal going into the original project. By the end of the project, only 11 of the 14 projectors were still working, and it was long past its life. There were a couple of other delays in doing this RFP, but we were down to the point where we were purchasing parts on eBay. And so one projector would have one failure and another would have a different type, so we'd steal parts from that. I mean, our technicians really did a great job limping this on along as long as possible. And so we really feel like we got as long and then some out of the old system.
And the good thing is we'll be able to relocate it.
Yes. Yes, and that's the other thing, that if we do end up moving forward with a new building and moving to that, this system can be moved to the new building as well.
Cool.
Any further questions? Gentlemen, thank you.
Thank you.
Appreciate
thank
it very,
you very
much.
I'd like to continue to pick up some of the afternoon items because we're ahead of schedule this morning, and invite Stacy Jagler to come up and talk about the recent conclusions from our state audit.
Hi, I'm Stacy Jagler, Internal Audit Manager for the district. And as Steve mentioned, we held a special audit committee meeting on November 26th to hear the results of the State Auditor's Office 2017 Accountability Audit. Commissioner Bowles and Commissioners McKenna were at that meeting, and we also provided a copy of the results of that to the other commissioners. Remember, you got a packet like this in your offices, but just wanted to, again, share the results of those to the entire board. A couple really great things out of that audit that was a good thing for the district. They had estimated the cost of the audit was going to be $45,000, and they actually came in under budget at $35,000. So I think we're finding year after year from a budget perspective that our audits are so clean and efficient that they're just not utilizing all the hours they project for the audit. So that was great that we're continuing to come under budget. From their office, the results of that audit, they looked at decentralized cash receipting out at our Leavenworth, Chelan, and BB Park area. They actually took, you know, deposits and traced those all out to make sure all the money collected was receipted. They looked at utility billings and adjustments, our net metering and electric, fiber, and water services. They hit P cards again pretty hard this year. But with what internal audit does, they were able to utilize any of those that they picked. We had already looked at. They were able to capture those results. They looked at payroll over time and support for pay increases. Sure, they also looked at our debt service payoff and our financial condition. And then they always look at procurement, and they looked at some of our sole source purchases and also just our large Rock Island contract, strictly from a sense of did we comply with bid laws when we were out awarding that contract. So we had a clean audit, which means this time for us we had no recommendations whatsoever. We had no verbal recommendations or exit recommendations. And I think their lead auditor stated that this was the cleanest audit that he had ever been on with his tenure with the state. So it was just a great, great result for us overall. We worked really hard with the state auditor's office, and a couple items that they were going to recommend, we were able to show them that we had mitigating controls in place. So they ended up not making any recommendations whatsoever. And that's the first audit I've been involved where we've had no recommendations. Even exit. So just wanted to share, I think, those really good results with all of you today from the state auditor's office.
Wonderful job.
Good result.
Very good result.
Yeah, it was.
I grew up in the securities industry where we get audited every which way but loose, and I can't remember in 36 years when I've ever had nothing discovered. Yeah. So fabulous job.
Yeah. It was great.
Yeah.
Thank you.
Commissioners, if I could, I think I want to thank Stacy and Melinda and the rest of the team, Diane and the group, the under budget results, even the state when they were here, those of you that were here to attend told us that it was a substantial amount of work up front done by the district staff to get information over to the state to make their review more smooth, more easy, and more accelerated, that contributed to the cost savings to the district. And I want to congratulate our district's internal team on the work that they've been doing over the last half a dozen or more years to really improve the working relationships between our staff and the auditors from the state, and to help them understand how we do business and the things that are important to us. And those have really been, I think, efforts that have shown fruit. We are each year tend to get a little bit cleaner audit. Our communications are more cooperative, and we've really come to understand the expectations of the state and what they're looking for, and they've come to learn more of the district. And it's really actually making the process more and more enjoyable. And I want to say thanks to the state auditors who are here and their approach to the audit this year as well.
Yep. Our relationship's getting better, and we're partnering with them and really ending up for a good result for us.
Do you notice, you know, as they've had their change in leadership and some struggles there, has their efficiency and administrative efficiency, have we noticed any problems dealing with them? I know this is a very vague question, but they've struggled, and it just seemed like this went very well, and I was very impressed with that.
Yeah, and I think, Eric can attest, as the years have gone, they've gotten different staff in there, and certainly our local audit manager at the time, Brandy Pritchard, who now is the PUD specialist. She's moved into a different role. I was instrumental in our office and still is involved in them. It really makes a difference in the type of person, I think, that's in that role. And even from the elected position, Pat McCarthy and her kind of tone and approach, mm-hmm. With the auditors in there, on their approach, and the ones most recently, they've been a lot more flexible easier to work with and more willing to listen to our, you know, just approaches and other controls and other things that we have in place, and just more willing to partner and work with that. And I think over the past couple of years, the different staff at our local team and over the PUDs in general that work with Waputa. I know Brandy and a couple of her staff from the Wenatchee office go to the Waputa meetings and just talk about different things going on at the state auditors, risks that they see, things that they're going to be looking for in their upcoming audits. It gives us a heads up, and we can start preparing for that. But they're just sharing more information and being more open. And I think that's really helped. The PUDs are their cleanest audit group from a state level, and I think their willingness to come to Waputa meetings and participate and share information and work with us has really made a big difference.
Mm-hmm. Good.
For me, there seemed, at least for a while, a little bit of a gotcha mentality.
Yep.
And I think it was a noticeable change in this audit report to more of a team approach, to work more cooperatively with each other. And so, yeah, I felt
it's more service-oriented.
Yeah, a tone change, which I think... Yeah. Has a better result.
Yeah, I totally agree. It was, I think, a big step for them, in my opinion, to actually, for an entity our size, come forward and say that we're not going to recommend anything. I think in the past they felt that just to, show their value, that they need to come up with something. We need to have some type of recommendations, and they weren't that meaningful. And I think they're really trying to take a step back, and they want those recommendations to be meaningful. And if they don't have any, then they don't have any. Yeah. And that, I think, was the first time I'd seen them really, step back and say, we don't have anything of value to add here, so we're not even going to make any recommendations. That was a big
thing, too. Thank you.
And there was a little humor in the room.
There was. That's good.
There was.
Always a positive thing.
Yeah.
Yeah.
That's great. So,
any other questions for Stacey? Thank you, Stacey.
Yeah, thank you.
Thank you.
I'd like to, if I could, move to an agenda item from this afternoon, agenda 17. This is not on the consent agenda, so it would require board action, but we're a little bit ahead of schedule. Opportunity to get Scott Tidd up to describe what's going on down at Rock Island, Unit B5. And Kirk's going to join him, and that will allow Scott to also not have to hang around for this afternoon and be able to get some of that massive workload that he's got to work on, get some of that done.
Thank you, Steve. So, you want to introduce, or you want me to?
We did that this morning, so here's Scott again.
Okay. Okay. So this resolution that was going to be presented later today is in regards to Powerhouse One, a unit in the B5 through B10. 0401B contract rehabilitation program. And this asks for issuance of the order to proceed. So where we are with B5 right now is that we've already authorized purchase of a lot of parts, engineering, manufacture, supply of a lot of parts, but we have not released the unit for the remainder of the parts procurement, nor planning the site work. By contract, we've got to give them a notice or an order to proceed within 12 months of asking them to, that we're going to give them the unit and they can proceed with the site work. So there's still some decisions that have to be made as far as timing, but we're feeling pretty sure that it could happen within the next 12 months from now. Ondritz is in the process of rehabilitating B7, and it's slated to be back online in July timeframe. And I think the general feeling has been that B5 would follow. There's a couple of things that we need to mention here. One is that there's escalation also in the contract. So that's labor, materials, escalation. We're subject to pay that after January of 2017. So it's just been kind of a matter of time. Where are we going to lock in the schedule? What is that going to be worth? So by asking you to authorize the order to proceed now, it's going to mitigate that additional cost, as well as it gets the project team that we can start looking at planning that outage. The other thing is, part of the resolution is to ask for a new head cover. So on the third unit and the fourth unit, which would be B6 and B7, we've pulled out the existing head cover and we have discovered cracks. And these are cast iron components and very difficult to repair. You've already authorized a new head cover for B7. This resolution asks for a new head cover for B5. And that's worth about $490,000. So it does a couple of things. One is it minimizes the escalation if we order that now. And it also minimizes a delay, or it could even avoid the delay. So when we authorized the B7 new head cover, it basically certified a four-month delay into that project, because it just, it's going to take that long to manufacture it. So by getting that authorization, we're going to avoid that delay. So then we get into probably the biggest potential hang-up, and that is everybody's concern over the vibration of the units out there. I'm going to state my confidence in that I think we're going to get it figured out. I don't think the vibration has been a contributing factor to the recent problems that we had with the Kaplan pipe failure, as well as the stator move. Both of those things we think partially field installation problems that I think we've corrected, but I don't think it had to do with the vibration. So
I might add this, you might, on the delegated action item list for the board meetings, one of them is to circle back with the board on the vibration concerns with B9. And so this was one of those that we had, boy, we want to keep the project moving. We don't have that issue resolved yet. So one of the things we're committing to do here is actually in the field work order, put some handles on resolving that vibration issue. And, we'll have to work with Ondritz on dates by which we can resolve that. And that's, they've got a plan to collect some data and analyze the data. We have to commit on our end, and we're going to have to come up with a commitment ourselves, and that is to give them the unit, which is to take the unit down by such and such a date. And that we're going to have to work through, just given all the problems we have out there. But it's certainly a two-part commitment that we want to put in this field work order that says let's resolve this issue by a date that works for both of us.
So, yeah, I think that pretty much covers it. If you've got questions. I might add one thing. We're also asking for, so we're in the process of negotiating the delay costs with Ondritz, and I think the resolution asks for authorization for the GM to include that delay cost in, it would be field work order 5-03, which is underway. So field work order 503 is the order to proceed, but then it's, we'll also put some hooks in it over the vibration situation that Kirk's talking about. And thirdly, I think that's the one that says the general manager he can authorize us including those delay costs in that field work order.
So Scott needs to learn when he has a yes and there aren't any questions. I just wanted to Commissioners,
they call that overselling. Yes.
Commissioners, I just wanted to say that it does include that provision that Scott mentions, and it is if it can be negotiated on terms acceptable to the general manager before the field work order is executed. If not, then we bring back in the ordinary course. So,
we're committed to keeping the board informed of that discussion.
That kind of illustrates field work and policy work. Okay, we want you to be in order, and then it's like just have to ask to go, So there is some interest, commissioners, in terms of taking Resolution 17 as a separate item, you know, at this point, as a means of confirming the work that's been done in the relationship with Andrus and moving forward with this project. So your desires, your direction.
Well, then I'll move approval, Mr. Chairman, of Resolution 17, authorizing the issuance of an order to proceed for the fifth unit rehab under contract number 0401 Part B for the Rock Island B5, B10 through B10 rehab project with Andritz Hydro Corp, and approving execution of field work order change order number 5-03 for release of the remaining work and execution of field work order / change order number 5-04 for purchase of a new outer head cover.
Second.
It's been moved and seconded to accept Resolution 17 as presented. Discussion? Hearing none, those in favor of 17 as presented signify by saying aye.
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 Opposed, no. The motion is carried.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Commissioners, at this point, we have one other regular agenda item, but I think it's possible that the mayor of Antioch may be coming for that one, so I'd rather hold off just in case he is. And we have one manager's item that I just need to do a little bit more work on, so I'd like to hang on to that one before the afternoon as well. So that leads us actually to commission items.
What? Could we approve the consent agenda this morning also?
Oh, I'm sorry. You could do that. Yes.
You may. Yeah. I would move approval of the consent agenda.
Second.
It's been moved and seconded to accept the consent agenda as amended. Is there discussion? Those in favor of accepting the consent agenda as amended signify by saying aye.
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 Opposed, no. Motion is carried.
Commission item?
Oh, there's my, looking for my second page. So we're looking at item what, 24? That's it, that commission items. Anything?
I do. Last week I had the opportunity to approve the Washington State Rewire Conference, which is in part sponsored by our PUD Association, Pfizer Chemical, I'm not sure who all else, and it's billed as a high-level policy discussion on what we may be looking at during this upcoming legislative session starting in January. And I told Steve this morning that I found this a very, very informative conference that was held great value for me personally as a PUD commissioner. Just to share with you the what I attended, and then a couple of the keynotes. The morning keynote had to do with transparency and governance, and we may or may not be aware that there's quite a debate going at the legislative level on Public Records Act, and the fact that it only entity that it does not apply to, I guess there's two, or Washington State Supreme Court and the legislature. The governor's office is subject to it, and so there's quite a debate emerging, if not raging, as to whether the legislature should cover itself with that. And you tie that with the key questions that we sometimes ask here at the utility and the county level about the burden that's placed on us and our ability to recover some costs associated with it. I don't think any of us is requesting to be exempted, but maybe to have some little assistance in terms of the cost of covering it more than what we currently have. That was a very interesting conversation with the publisher of the Seattle Times, the president of TVW, and the Senate chair of the Senate Law and Justice Committee. So that was fascinating opening. The next session that I went to is Next Steps on Climate, Clean Energy, and Electrification. And George Kahn was one of the presenters, as was Representative Mary Dye from, I think she's from Pomeroy, if I'm not mistaken, and Representative Beth Doglio. And it was a real good conversation about where they saw potential legislation going in this upcoming session, and they do see some real interesting legislation emerging, and there's potential for a lot of plans, but stay tuned. The next segment that I went to is Orcas, Salmon, and Dams. Is a balance possible? And that, too, was, you know, well-attended, and I thought I actually interjected on that one on, and maybe I was, I don't think I was out of line on behalf of Chelan PUD when the environmental reporter for KNKX stated unequivocally in the panel setting that it's a proven that increasing spill helps salmon survival. I couldn't let that one go by, and I suggested to her that we had done the scientific analysis with our HCP here and found that we actually could reduce spill and achieve no net loss of salmon in that process. And she was writing, so I don't know where that'll. We may get contacted by her at some moment in time. And then this one was for my own personal gratification. Is it time to reopen the Growth Management Act? That doesn't affect the utility, but it definitely affects Chelan County. And there is a growing body of chorus of people from both urban and rural areas that are seeing the constraints by GMA. And I've been long a critic of that ever since it went into the place, that it really did things not in the appropriate fashion for the best interest of the people of the state. Luncheon keynote speaker was Commissioner of Public Lands Hillary Franz, whose conversation with us didn't sound like a policy speak as a Commissioner of Public Lands. It sounded more like a campaign speech for somebody that might be running for something other than Commissioner of Public Lands. We'll have to wait and see. But she is a spark plug. She's a dynamo, and she's earned, I think, high marks on this side of the state in the last couple of years for the way she's been handling our wildfire situation. So stay tuned on that. And then I went to a couple other sessions, but the last one I'd like to mention is strategies to narrow the divide between rural and urban Washington. And on that, had the opportunity to meet Representative Joe Schmick, whom I've heard of before, and we have a lot of mutual friends, but Angela Benick, who is the telecom business manager for Kitsap, more recently with NOAA, talked about how broadband has the great potential to help narrow the divide between rural and urban. So there was a great utility connection with this section also. So well done conference. It's done once a year. Our association, I think, plans on continuing to be a sponsor, and I can see why after attending it. So a recommended, I won't say must do, but very informative. I think it's going to help me going into the legislative session when we go to Olympia this winter. So, and there were five or six PUD commissioners there in attendance. You got this might bring a smile to your face, but it was really entertaining to see Tim Eyman and Chris Stearns engaged in conversation. Huh. Enough said.
Give me a second to recover. Okay, that being said, other commission items. So, one from me, and it moves nicely to Gary. In our first meeting, we will do the change of officers, and my recommendation has been that between now and then, we think about what roles individually we want to be involved in WPUDA and APPA and WPPA and, you know, those organizations, and be able to articulate those to the incoming president, and then be ready for that Division of Labor to cover those at our second meeting in January and be off and rolling for 2019. So, you know, that being said, if that's agreeable, come with your druthers. And Randy's going to be in a unique position of, well, that is, unless he screws up, being president of WPUDA. And so, you know, how you'll want to handle that and energy and, you know, other committees, you know, please, you know, come prepared to state that opinion. And then also, you know, any thoughts where we can play a role to support your opportunity as president of the association starting next spring and go from there.
Hey, Dennis, if I can just jump in.
Please.
And say one thing to build on what Dennis had said, as I've asked Rebecca to send out copies of all of the various organizations that are available to us as commissioners, and she'll send that out first of the year. Or sooner, so that we have it to look over and kind of refresh our memories as to what's available.
And recognizing that I am going to be the incoming president of the association, unless I screw up. And I've been a member, just for those there might be interest there, I've been a member and chair of the Energy Committee for many years at the association level, and if there's interest and desire on anybody's part to step into a role like that, I don't, I'm not owning that in perpetuity. I just, you know, just so if there is interest, I'm happy to step aside if somebody wants to dive in more.
Okay. Any other commissioner items? Hearing none. Is there a follow-up on a delegation of action items? Or?
We have a couple, actually, yes. So we had one with respect to providing the commission some information about the Rewire conference, which Commissioner Smith has just identified. So you all should have gotten an email from Sean Smith about that. And then we have one that comes back from a previous meeting, and that's his... we had a constituent, Nick Martini, who had expressed concerns about how his particular location would work under the cryptocurrency rate. I know Eric's been working on that. He's got a report for you.
Sure, commissioners. Thanks. I need to say thank you to John Stoll's group, Chad Risman, Andy Wendell, Lyle Moore. We've actually been working pretty fast and furious, particularly since the moratorium was lifted for current applicants to get some additional information out to Mr. Martini. I've actually been corresponding with him in the last couple of days, including this morning. And that information should hit his mailbox in short order, which would basically give him the information that he was looking for at the last time he was before the board, sort of the plan for his property, how it might be served in terms of orientation of assets, what some of those costs were for line extension and improvements related to his application, so that he could go ahead and move forward as he advised you last time, he wanted to with the planning and ultimately construction of one of his outbuildings that would house his servers, assuming that's appropriately permitted in the city of Wenatchee. So I think he is, staff and Mr. Martini are both well engaged, and with your permission, would remove this one from the future action items. I think that this one is well underway and will be closed out in some due course. If not, I'm sure Mr. Martini will be here letting you know his thoughts on that. He's actually been very good to work with, very cooperative. Our teams have been out. I personally have been out to his site and his property, and I think things have been moving pretty well.
Thank you, Eric.
Thank you. There's some unique things about the situation and his location that can potentially provide some value to the district, too. So it turns out there's something of value here. So. That's it. Other than I did want to mention one other thing, which is you are aware that we have been very active with the public generating pool, doing work on looking at the least cost approach to greenhouse gas emissions. Did a study in 2017, updated it in 2018. We have a new piece of that work that has been put together between the publics and also Avista, Northwestern, and Puget Sound Energy have been part of this discussion as well, coming out after the first of the year. Looks at the reliability implications of trying to get to a 100% greenhouse gas emissions target. We'd expressed before that it's possible to do. It's not cheap, but it's possible to do to get to about 80% reduction in the electric sector, but it's a hockey stick approach after that. So we've done much more detailed work looking at that now, and we will be able to describe what the issues are there. Fundamentally, the biggest problem is that in the Northwest, the reliability event is a cold weather snap that extends for 4 to 5 days combined with a low water situation. And storage batteries, which generally today work in the 4 to 8 hour time frame, don't solve the problem. So you end up buying lots and lots of storage batteries in order to be able to cover that. Or you end up buying lots and lots of renewable resources that end up having to be curtailed because you have so much oversupply. So you're curtailing them in large portions of the year, and then you need them for very, very small fractions of the time. So it's a pretty inefficient way of addressing the reliability concern. We actually have invited the consultant who's done this work to come and join us, and he will be here the meeting right after President's Day in February to be able to go through this whole series of work that we've done, going back to some of the original studies. You may recall, we started this with the Chelan PUD study, and then that morphed into this larger set of studies that have been developed. Just going to walk through that progression of how we got there, give you a chance to be able to see it and understand it in a little bit of detail, and ask him whatever questions that you might want to have. So he's going to join us, and something just to look forward to.
Good.
Yeah, I think it's
third Monday of February.
Third Monday, I think.
Well, President's Day is Monday, and the meeting will be on Tuesday.
Yeah, what day is that?
I think it's the 19th, but don't quote me.
I think President's Day is the third Monday.
Yes.
Yeah. So our meeting's on a Tuesday.
I'm looking. There's Monday in January.
February.
February.
Oh, well, that changes everything.
President's Day is the 18th of February.
Yeah, so that's correct. So it'll be the 19th of February.
I almost have all of next year's schedule memorized.
Okay, and I think that's it for what we can accomplish this morning. We have just one regular agenda item, one manager's item for this afternoon, and then we have an executive session. So we should be able to get into executive session pretty quickly, and thinking no more than 60 minutes per executive session.
Okay.
It'll take longer.
Yeah. Thank you. I appreciate that.
Delegation of action items. We'll do that.
I wanted to hang on to that just because we weren't finished with the other two items in case something came up.
Right. Just wanted to make sure. All right. With that being said, we will adjourn for lunch and return at 1 o'clock. I think so.
But it wasn't me this time.
I'm not sure.
Nope.
Good afternoon and welcome to Chelan County Public Utility District Board of Commissioners meeting. It is 1:02, and all commissioners are here. qualifies as a quorum, and we have moved through a good deal of our agenda, and we will open with a regular agenda item number 14, and also present.
And you know, cell phone, and the area code looks like a number that I know, so I pick it up. Please stop the robocall.
It's on.
I can't
it's
do it.
It's on silent.
Really?
I so apologize. It's on totally on silent.
She was on silent.
And well, that $5.
$20.
You know, there's an option. We can either make it through a random address in Albuquerque or $5. I don't care.
It's 50 in court.
50 in court. And with us this afternoon, also as a part of the audience, and should you choose to speak, is Mayor of Enneat, John Ault. And welcome, John. Appreciate you being here. So item 14, please.
This is a resolution approving agreements to amend and restate an interlocal agreement with the City of Enteat and authorizing the general manager and or his designee to execute the agreements, clarifying the location of property and property rights to be granted to permit the construction of marina facilities. Vicki Griffin presenting.
Vicki Griffin, or the Lands and Real Estate Department. You might remember this came before the board on July 9th of this year to amend and restate an interlocal agreement that was done in about 2011. The original interlocal agreement had misstated the location of the marina, and this interlocal agreement correctly identifies that location. So the original agreement had identified that the marina would be up here on this area that's in blue, which is owned by the City of Enneat, with the district having a flowage easement below that. The actual location is down here in the red. This is kind of known as Knife Island. It's in between Red and Knife Island on both City of Enneat property and district property. So the interlocal agreement just corrects that and identifies the correct property for that. Since then, the City of Enneat has been working on some due diligence items. That's kind of why we haven't been back before that time. Does anybody have any questions on that?
So current status is we're ready to go.
We are ready to file with FERC as soon as we get the agreement signed.
Okay.
And the City of Enneat has signed, their board met and signed the agreement. So.
Great.
So, Vicki, can you just point out some, or maybe John, when he comes up, some landmarks?
Sure.
So I can get my bearing. I just want to drive by it.
Sure. So here's the ball fields up here.
Okay.
City Hall is probably back here where you can't see it. I apologize for that. The City of Enneat Park, the park is down below that as well. I didn't bring another slide that shows that. I apologize.
So the north end of the park is adjacent to
probably
it.
Probably 300 yards or so south of that.
There's some private property between
them. There is. There's a little subdivision in between the two.
Yeah.
Okay.
Commissioners, item 14, what's your desire?
Does the mayor want to speak to it first or not? I mean, it doesn't matter to me.
Either way, yep. Thank you very much. Please come on up and use the microphone because we're recorded.
I just wanted to take a moment just to come and thank all of the staff and the commissioners for considering this opportunity for Enneat. It's a been a number of years coming. I think if we had known what we were up against when we started, we probably would have been a lot more afraid of the situation. But now that it's over, we're really excited about that and the opportunities that are coming. I just wanted to just take a moment and just really point out the diligence and the effort with your staff has been just phenomenal. Our relationship is, I think, really, while it was good before, has really blossomed over the last number of months. Met a lot of the folks here, and every one of them has been very accommodating and willing to just step up and do whatever they could to assist us, and that's been really helpful. We're looking forward to a continued relationship that's going to be good. We've got some other projects on the burner as well, and we're excited about those. So, yeah, as far as the way this is going to go, we're already working. Actually, we're working with some of the actually the railroads with conversations about trying to move material. We can start in earnest with some conversations that have come up over the last number of months from some investors, including including restaurants and hotels and things like that, that have expressed an interest that we felt we kind of had to wait to be able to address some of their ideas in more detail. That's kind of it. Really do, once again, appreciate all the assistance, and we really value the business relationship and the really consider the PUD as a really great business partner for us.
Very good. It's something that we've worked at in earnest pretty diligently for the last X number of years. And I remember thinking at one point, if I can just ever go to a meeting in any hat and not feel like you've been skewered after you come out. But it was a series of promises made and promises broken, and we didn't always fulfill our, you know, end of it. And there's been a concerted effort to move in that direction, and it just fostering that relationship has just gotten better and better, and things have progressed, to match that. So we appreciate the kind words. That's kind of a validation of, you know, what you think or you feel, and it's good to hear it from the Indiana community. So thank you.
Great.
Yeah. And that's not an indictment of anybody. It's just a statement of where things were and where they are, and happy to be where they are.
It is in fact, really neat to see that. The blossoming of the relationship, as you stated it. Sort of a follow-up on Dennis's comments. One of the first meetings I went to up in Antioch, many years ago, was held in the cafeteria of the school, and I hope the mural on the wall is never lost.
Yeah.
I don't know, you guys at some point will probably want to build a new school, but you somehow have to cut that section of wall out and keep it in perpetuity. It's an important piece of history, but I am curious on this piece of land. How much river frontage is the marina going to, how long is that piece of property?
Well, it's actually this whole area, the section that Vicki noted is Knife Island, which basically,
sorry, I got another picture if I can figure out how to get to it.
Sure. I should have brought you some of our drawings. We actually all the way up through, quite a bit of engineering that's already been completed.
Okay. Sorry. So this shows you where the Eniat Park is.
There you go.
Proposed marina, and the marina takes up a good portion of that area. And then there's a drawing of the marina, just a
looks like at least a couple hundred feet or maybe three.
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah.
That'll be nice.
This is a fairly updated piece of that. We've got some more engineering done. Other pieces that we're kind of excited about are the Planning Commission has actually rezoned the piece just on the other side of the railroad tracks that basically parallels that whole marina section on the western side.
That's right.
That's what we call an area of waterfront transition now that used to be classified just as commercial property. So that piece of property, those properties now are all available now for multifamily, for condos and those type of things.
Oh, wow.
Where they were only available for commercial development before, so it's a transition area for us. As the current contractor that's doing the excavation there continues, that section will continue to become low bank waterfront as we go up, so there'll be two levels of capacity there, one in the lower level where we could have the on water presence, and then a whole area up above where people will still have views of the water residential. So we're kind of excited about that. There was an Our Valley, Our Future plan that just came out that part of my staff and myself were available working on as well. If you get an opportunity to read that, it gives you some kind of pretty good sound bites and highlights of some of the opportunities that are coming up for Indiana. We've already been working with some of your folks planning a whole new power grid for that area. And,
Great.
I was telling John, some of my friends who are tired of all the hustle and bustle and too many people in Schlan are moving to Antioch. Either they're moving to Montana, Idaho, or Antioch. Quite a few of them really have moved up the Ardenbor. It's beautiful.
You're
up in there. You're
equating Antioch with Montana. I've got to think about that.
Uh-oh, he's a Montana guy. Well, yeah, kind of. But, and the water skiers, you know, the best water skiing is definitely not on Lake Chelan. It's on the river.
Well, this will definitely disrupt my water skiing. It's going to get me up a little earlier than I planned.
Exactly.
Actually happens. I'm willing to share. we're trying to change the perception. When people think of Enneat, they do think quite a ways up the valley. We're still trying to change the perception that you need a pack of lunch to get to us. We're close.
Yep.
That's changed as well.
Yeah. That's cool. That's great.
Thanks for coming.
Yeah. Thank you. Thank you for your
time. Yeah.
Appreciate it.
Thank you, John.
I'd like to move approval of Resolution 14, if I may.
Second.
Okay. It's been moved and seconded to approve Resolution 14. Is there further discussion? Hearing none, those in favor signify by saying aye.
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 Opposed, no. Motion is carried. And then I think we're back to manager items.
It does bring us to the end of the regular agenda. We had one manager item we had left. I want to talk to you a little bit about the Tumwater facility. Erickson, Aline Underwood. Give you a description of an emerging issue.
Good afternoon. Justin Erickson, Managing Director of District Services, and joining me today is Aline Underwood, Fish and Wildlife Manager. I'm going to talk to you today about Tumwater Dam and the fishway associated therewith. I think you're all probably familiar with that area, but it's on right off of Highway 2, 5 miles west of Leavenworth. The dam itself was completed in 1909 as part of efforts related to the Great Northern Railway, and PUD retained ownership of it in 1957, and this fishway was constructed in 1987. The district recently conducted some underwater investigations in the vicinity of the dam and the fishway, centered around lamprey and whether or not they were using the facility and how they were interacting with the structures. And in doing so, we uncovered some erosion along the lower fishway and along the viewing area bulkhead, and Aline will kind of highlight that there on that aerial. This fishway is important to us, important to our operations. We collect adult fish there. It's essential to meeting our HCP hatchery programs and obligations, and so these repairs that it appears that we need to make are essential going forward. So we're going to look at this in a couple of different ways. What we're doing immediately or in the very near future is to do some exploratory drilling so that we can take some core samples, understand the structural integrity of the structure itself, also the subsurface materials and the foundation materials. And this work is scheduled to be completed shortly after Christmas time. We believe that the drilling apparatus will be out there on December 26th. Should be maybe a couple of days of drilling, and then we'll be able to review those results and analyze them and evaluate next steps, which could include the finalization of project specifications and bidding documents for repair work that could be done in February and early March. So, and also in an anticipatory step, we've also, we have the environmental permitting well underway so that we can meet those timeframes should they occur. Also of note is the public viewing area, which is fairly heavily utilized at this facility. This will be closed from on or before December 26th as we prepare for that drilling activity. And then onward while we go through that evaluation phase and then make any necessary repairs. So that will be closed next week going forward. Anything you'd like to add?
Estimate of how long?
Well,
the project will take?
You know, it kind of depends on the scope of the project. What we are assuming right now is that some repairs will be necessary. We're hoping that those repairs will be somewhat limited in scope, in which case those repairs would be able to be made in February and early March prior to high flows and prior to the fish hatches really becoming critical.
Yeah, you have windows, really specific windows you have to meet, huh?
Yes, and typically February is the time where we take any outages in the fishway anyway to do maintenance work there. So the good news is if any work does need to occur, whatever that is, we'll actually be able to leave the fishway open, because most of the work will occur at the sill, kind of on the outer edge here. So the fishway will remain open if a fish does come along and want to be up there.
Alina, a little history question that you may not be able to answer. One of my earliest memories as a child of this dam was the salmon trying to get over the dam, the leaping salmon. And we put the fishway in, you said, in the 70s?
87.
There wasn't always a fish ladder at the dam, or was there?
There was. So the previous fish ladder, I don't know exactly when it was constructed, but there was a fish ladder on the opposite bank.
Okay.
Here. And then in the early 80s, I think 80, 81, the Northwest Power Council actually identified this particular area as someplace that could benefit from fish passage. So Bonneville actually picked up the project and then installed this fish passage structure in 87.
That was Bonneville.
Mm-hmm.
Interesting. Okay.
It was off-site mitigation, yeah.
But what I don't see anymore are the salmon trying to leap up the dam. They've gotten lazy. They're going up the fishway, right?
That's right.
I thought before that only the strong really survived and made it up there. So.
Well, and the good part of this, too, is we see very, very few salmon moving this time of year that the work would occur. That's why we typically have an outage in February. So, you know, we may see one or two or six fish. So this time of year.
So did the railroad actually generate any power or actually use the – they did generate electricity with this dam?
Yeah, there used to be a power – well, there was, a powerhouse downstream because there was a penstock that went down quite a ways. Yeah.
Hmm.
I think the electric railroad was only a few years, but this was I looked around the room and I figured I guess I'm the resident historian on that dam.
Well, we won't say why. We won't point out why.
So you may see some activity, or others may see some activity out there in the next couple of weeks. We've got some reconnaissance work to do. We'll be getting back to the board after the first season to begin to see results to give you a sense of what we find.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thanks.
Thank you very much. So does that conclude Manager Adams?
It does.
Okay. So it would be 26, Delegation of Action Adams.
Yeah, you've got the same thing I've got. So we don't have any action items reported from today, unless we miss something.
Okay.
As he says with a smile on his face.
Pretty rare, isn't it, Steve?
It has been.
Yeah. Merry Christmas.
Item 27, additional public comments. And any other matters to, of general business to come before the commission? Hearing none, we will then move to executive session and the duration.
60 minutes.
And since we just came back from lunch, just move straight into it. Okay. So at this point, the commission will move into executive session to discuss with legal counsel agency enforcement actions, litigation, potential litigation, to which the district or its board is or is likely to become a party, and or legal risk as authorized by RCW 42.30.110I1I. To consider information regarding the infrastructure and security of computer and telecommunications network, security and service recovery plan, security risk assessment, and security test results, to the extent that they identify specific system vulnerabilities pursuant to RCW 42.30.1101A II, and to review the performance of a public employee as authorized by RCW 42.30111G, to last approximately 60 minutes. So we will immediately move in at 1:23 and hope to be concluded by 2:23 or earlier. This is the Chelan County Board of Commissioners coming back into session on December 17th, 2018 from our executive session, where no decisions were made, no votes were taken, and there is no other items to come before the commission today, so we are adjourned.